An okay bath.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, March 23rd, 2017. One correction on the agenda. We will not be hearing House Bill 2621 today. We're going to hold that over. And we're going to go out of order. I'm going to have a call a work session on House Bill 2409.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2409 permits cities to operate cameras and sensors on streetlights or other suitable places for the purpose of issuing traffic tickets for speeding in excess of 10 miles per hour. There is a -3 amendment before you today. The -3 amendment prohibits a city from issuing both a speeding ticket and a red light ticket unless the driver exceeds the speed limit by more than 21 miles per hour. The -3 amendment also makes a handful of technical changes that I will spare you in the interest of time. With the -3 amendments, both the fiscal impact and the revenue impact are indeterminate.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendments into House Bill 2409.
Representative Olson moves the -3 amendments into House Bill 2409. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2409 as amended to the House floor with due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Thank you. Representative Olson moves House Bill 2409 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with referral to Revenue. Is there any discussion? Are there any?
Call the roll.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Greenlick?
Yes, I guess.
good guess.
Oh, of course, whatever he tells me. Oh, that's a scary world. Oh, my.
Representative Leiniger?
Yes.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Sanchez?
Yes.
Representative Springer?
Yes.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative Vile?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Excused.
Chair
Barker? Aye. Motion carries.
You don't need to carry right now. Okay.
We don't need to carry yet. Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll go up and open a public hearing on House Bill 2955. Representative Leiniger, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2955 elevates the crime of strangulation from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony when the victim is a family or household member. The bill also includes knowingly impeding normal breathing or circulation of blood through the application of pressure to the chest as a means by which the crime may be committed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Gina Skinner, Aaron Greenwald, and Melissa. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative
Gorsuch. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leiniger, State Representative for Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. And I'm happy to be here today in support of House Bill 2955, which has the support of Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson and Representative Vile also. I'm glad that we're together on this bill. It accomplishes the important the important task of updating Oregon's law related to strangulation in a domestic violence context to make sure that that offenses of this type become C felonies instead of Class A misdemeanors. And the reason, in my view, that this is so important, and you're going to hear from other witnesses today to talk about it, is that strangulation in the context of a household relationship, of a family relationship, is one of the greatest red flags that domestic violence is moving toward lethality of any other predictors. So it has such an extreme link to eventual homicide by domestic violence that it's really important that we identify, in my view, strangulation by a household member or family member as an aggravating factor alongside aggravating factors such as in the presence of a child to take what has been a misdemeanor and put it into C felony status. And I know that there are thoughtful reasons to be cautious about when we make new felonies. And in my estimation, the link to lethality is so profound that this is absolutely one of the times that we need to be willing to take the step and update our law, joining what is now a large number of states who have moved their strangulation penalties in this context from misdemeanor to felony and also make it a felony. And there are many people in this room with even more insight on the issue than me, but I would welcome any really easy questions that you'd like to address.
Thank Thank you, Representative.
Okay.
Okay, I'll call Gina Skinner, Aaron Greenwald, and Kim Larson, please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Barker. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Washington County. I've been a deputy district attorney now. This is my 20th year. And I have focused the majority of my career on the prosecution of domestic violence crimes. This is a very wonderful day for the Oregon District Attorneys Association, who's in support of this bill. I actually worked in a work group back in 2003 to draft the original misdemeanor strangulation bill here in Oregon. That was based on the need, significantly, as previously mentioned by Representative Leininger, for having a penalty specifically associated with the crime of strangulation. Of course, the majority of those cases that we see and that we prosecute are associated with domestic violence. Originally, the bill, we wanted it to be a felony, and we had to compromise and make it solely a misdemeanor. I have come back to this legislative body almost every session, if not every session, and I have testified regarding the crime of strangulation, and we have slowly and slowly added subparts that have increased the penalty to felonies under certain circumstances. But now, this is the year that we're asking 14 years later to make the entire bill associated with domestic violence relationships to be a felony. This bill is doing two things. The first of which is to add the action of placing pressure on someone's chest to also be included in the definition of strangulation. I have seen a number of cases in my caseload where somebody has literally suffocated somebody by putting significant pressure by either lying on them, pinning them down, or in an act of power and control have prevented the usually much smaller and weaker partner to be able to breathe. And that currently is not covered. It isn't covered as an assault, and it is not covered under strangulation currently. And so that would criminalize that behavior. But more commonly, what this bill will be affecting more significantly will be the number of scenarios that currently are a misdemeanor that will be covered as a felony. So the relationships that this specifically will address is what's defined as a family or household member. And under Oregon law, that currently covers spouses, former spouses, adult persons related by blood or marriage, persons that are cohabitating with each other, which is further defined in case law as cohabitating together akin to a spouse. So this is not talking about roommates. This is not talking about other parties that just happen to be residing in the same residence. And then also persons who have cohabitated as a spouse or who have been involved in a sexually intimate relationship. So that's the nature of the persons that are specifically will be addressed in this bill. As previously mentioned, the potential lethality regarding the correlation between strangulation and death is significant. And it is the same whether or not the crime is a misdemeanor or a felony. So the point is that the penalty needs to be associated with the level of risk. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence has estimated that strangulation is one of the top five risk factors associated with homicide in domestic violence. And a domestic violence victim who has been strangled is statistically 9 times more likely to be killed than a victim who has never been strangled. Strangulation can cause unconsciousness in a matter of seconds and death within a matter of minutes. And the repeated risk of strangulation is so much higher for the potential lethality when you're talking about domestic partners because of the proximity of them in the same residence, because of the power and control relationship associated between the parties. And the reality is that this behavior continues in frequency, and it will continue over time until, unfortunately, something very significant can occur. Another reason why the importance of having this become a felony in all domestic violence situations is because of the nature of the relationship, that these parties frequently will remain together in a relationship even though strangulation is occurring on a regular basis. And police may or may not ever be involved in the situation, is that for the cases when the police do get involved, that the person more likely than not will then be placed on formal probation. Most counties in Oregon currently do not formally supervise misdemeanors. They don't have the funds for it. And so those persons that are convicted of misdemeanor crimes, which is currently many of the strangulation convictions now, are going to be on bench probation. They will not have anyone monitoring them, and they will not have any consequences or potentially not even be referred to do any treatment because there'll be no one watching whether they're doing it or not. Because it would make all of these a C felony, those persons, when placed on formal probation, would more likely than not, in every county in Oregon, have a supervising probation officer, and that would be required to do treatment, domestic violence, alcohol, drug, parenting, whatever needs to be done to address the situation. And if you have limited or not on the higher level of a prior criminal history, you're still going to be presumptive probation. I mean, you're still going to be doing probation. You're not going to be going to prison unless you have a significant person's crime felony record already before you commit this felony strangulation. And finally, I'll conclude with, I went back and looked at the 2016 statistics for all the states in the United States based on the San Diego Training Institute on Strangulation, and they currently there are 34 other states where strangulation is exclusively prosecuted as a felony on their books. So we are now in the minority that this is a misdemeanor or a felony, depending on the circumstances, and we are just trying to get up to the point of where this should be prosecuted and where it is currently prosecuted in most states in the United States. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Vice Chair. My name is Erin Greenewald. I'm an attorney at the Oregon Department of Justice. Specifically, I'm the domestic violence resource prosecutor at the Oregon Department of Justice. I've been a prosecutor for 18 years, concentrating my practice on domestic and sexual violence. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice to testify in support of this bill. The two proposals that are put forth in 2955 are very, very important for the reasons, and I would echo what Ms. Skinner said. First, expanding the protections around the manner and form in which strangulation occurs. Domestic violence perpetrators, and I know several of you sitting here have lots of experience professionally with domestic violence and have seen it in your professional careers. Perpetrators are very creative in the ways that they can abuse and strangle. And so expanding the restrictions or the protections in this bill is very important. As Ms. Skinner said, those of us who have practiced have seen this time and time again, where unfortunately the behavior that the perpetrators use, the tactics that they use, just aren't covered by our existing criminal statutes. And then secondly, expanding the population of people who are protected, specifically to include family and household members, is particularly important because, as Gina said, domestic violence is about power and control. That's what it's based in, apart from and in addition to anger. And strangulation, we've seen on so many different levels, is one of the most effective tools of power and control. It doesn't take but perhaps one act of strangulation for the victim to get the clear message that though that perpetrator may not have killed me this time, he or she is very able to kill me next time. So for the law to recognize that act, that tactic of power and control, is really important. And again, I would just highlight what Ms. Skinner said, which is we have seen and research has demonstrated over the course of years that strangulation is one of the top factors and flags to indicate potential lethality. So with that, I again would urge your support of 2955 and would answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions, Representative Bile.
If this gets taken to trial, does the domestic violence piece, forgive me because I'm not a criminal law expert, but I understand that there are different counts that relate to domestic violence versus just the act itself. Does the fact that we've put that in the bill now complicate the trial environment?
I can answer that, or Ms. Skinner can answer that.
Chair Barker, Representative Bile, this wouldn't do anything to make it any different as far as our strategies or practices. We currently charge strangulation crimes, or at least most people charge them, with the language of constituting domestic violence if that relationship exists in the strangulation crime.
And it doesn't raise the burden of proof if you do that?
Chair Barker, Representative Bile, it does not.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Kim Larson. I'm the Director of Victim Assistance with the Marion County DA's office, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2955. I've been an advocate working within the criminal justice system for more than 20 years, and for a significant part of that time have worked exclusively with victims of domestic violence. In that time and in the work that I've done in the DA's office, have seen many police reports where officers have talked with victims about being strangled, where victims have talked about their experience. And when officers ask them, what were you thinking was going to happen when they were strangling you? They very often comment, I thought I was going to die. In that moment in time when their offender had his hands around their neck, they believed that they were not going to survive that assault. That's a pretty sobering statement that should remain at the forefront of our considerations when we're talking about strangulation in the context of domestic violence. In 2016, in our office, 15% of the domestic violence cases that we filed included strangulation charges. Our local domestic violence council has recognized the lethality of strangulation and has made it a priority within our community to train law enforcement around recognizing strangulation and asking the right questions. There often aren't marks that they see, and victims often don't describe it. And so being able to make sure they're doing those investigations thoroughly is important. And we know, as you've heard, domestic violence involves a pattern of abuse in order to exercise power and control over someone. And interfering with someone's ability to breathe is perhaps the ultimate form of control, whether that's putting their hands around someone's neck, whether it's kneeling on their chest so they can't breathe, or holding something over their face. Strangulation sends a very clear message, and that message is, I can take your life, and I'm capable of doing that. Strangulation also has significant and potentially long-lasting medical effects, both mental and physical. We've heard victims talk about just feeling like they're walking around in a fog. And not being able to process information and be able to use their judgment in making decisions around their safety because they're struggling just putting pieces together. What's really scary is that lethality risk from strangulation doesn't necessarily end when the assault ends. The resulting physical effects are often ignored, and we know that victims can die as a result of injuries caused by strangulation even days later. And when we're talking with victims, I've talked with victims who have, as they're talking to me, I can hear their voices raspy, and I'll ask them, is this always how your voice sounds? And they'll talk about, no, this is because of the assault. And then talking to them about, you know, the importance of being seen by a doctor and talking to them about the fact that they could still have things happening and as a result of their injury that could cause their death if it's not taken care of. And it's something that just isn't paid attention to a lot. Strangulation is, as we've talked about, one of the most lethal forms of domestic violence and one of the biggest predictors of homicide. I think the changes proposed in this bill are necessary to recognize that and to allow our system to appropriately hold people accountable for this increased level of violence with the hope that we can prevent homicides. And thank you for listening to me, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions, Representative Boyle?
Yeah, I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Very, very much in support of this bill, and in fact signed on to it because I feel so strongly about it. But I want to make sure, as I keep reading it over the last few days, we've got elements of a crime and then we've got enhancement pieces. And as I read this, I was worried that that was an enhancement versus an element, or vice versa, actually, and that would be a concern.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I'm glad that you brought that up again. I was thinking more about your question as Ms. Larson was testifying. So currently the way the bill is structured, it's mirrors also in the assault force statute in 163 and 160, where the element of the crime is the action that the defendant knowingly impedes the breathing or blood circulation by doing these different actions. So that's the crime of strangulation, and then that would be considered to be an A misdemeanor. And then if there's one of the following enhancements pled and proven by the state beyond a reasonable doubt, then that would make it a C felony. And so currently that includes if the victim is a child under 10, if the victim is pregnant, if the defendant has a prior conviction for assault, for menacing, or strangulation against the same party, or three prior convictions against any party in the past. So all of those are enhancements currently to the bill, or if a child witnesses, or it's done in the immediate present. So that's the way the bill is currently structured. This would add another enhancement in essence. So so that the state pleads and proves that this, the victim and the defendant's relationship, as defined in 135.230, to be a family or household member, then that would enhance the penalty to a C felony. That usually is not a difficulty for the state to prove that the parties are spouses or that they have a child in common. So that's actually a relatively simple thing for the state in all the elements to prove. Worst case scenario, for some reason the state couldn't prove that element, the state would still prove the crime of strangulation. It would just be to the level of a misdemeanor, and that would just add that it would be basically considered a lesser included crime.
Great. Thank you very much. Yeah, that was very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Sure. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I understand it right now, and I'm very supportive of the bill as well, when we have a child present and a crime, there are a number of things that are done in terms of assault, that it bumps it up a level. So would this be that we would bump it if a child was present from a C to a B felony?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, no. Okay. This would just be another way that it would have the same enhancement that currently exists for if a minor child of either party or a minor child that resides in the residence that either was in the immediate presence of or witnessed the strangulation.
So it would be the same thing.
It would be equal. The same.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Okay. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Next, I call Sheriff Roberts and Angie Brandenburg.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, and I'm appearing today in support of House Bill 2955, also representing the Chiefs Association and Oregon State Sheriffs Association that are both in support of this bill. With me is our Sheriff's Office Lieutenant Angie Brandenburg, who will speak to you about the everyday impacts of domestic violence and strangulation in these domestic violence cases, and really how all of us should be concerned about these strangulation cases. I just have to say, as a former detective director of a family violence unit and homicide detective, I can tell you that I've worked countless strangulation cases, and sadly, several of those cases were victims that did not survive. Really, in memory, I could mention several, but I want to mention two: Patricia Crabtree and Jennifer DeLapp, both strangulation cases. Patricia Crabtree still has not been found to this day. The suspect in that case obtained another girlfriend. He's strangling her. As she's just about ready to go unconscious, he says, "I'm going to do the same thing to you as I did to my first wife." And Patricia Crabtree worked at Intel, had a history of being strangled. Unfortunately, suspect in that case strangled her to death, put her in the car, stripped her of her clothes, put her two boys in the back seat, or he put his two boys in the back seat, drove to Estacada, and dumped her body in a rural area of Clackamas County. Both these cases had histories of strangulation that led up to this. So really, in memory of those two women, I want to tell you why I believe this bill really will save lives. Research confirms that strangulation violence is one of the most lethal forms of violence in domestic violence and sexual assault cases. However, historically, this lethal violence has been minimized. Why? Because most strangulation victims do not have visible injuries. And that has caused medical and law enforcement professionals to treat, oftentimes referred to as choking cases, as minor incidents and miss the signs of strangulation. Today, based on ongoing research, specialized training for medical professionals, police, and prosecutors, we know what to do and what to look for. We also know that strangulation is one of the best predictors of future homicide and domestic violence cases, and Senate Bill 2955 will prevent future homicides, hold offenders accountable for their crime, and increase victim safety. So before I introduce Lieutenant Brandenburg, I just want to tell you about the experience that supports her testimony today. Lieutenant Brandenburg is the director of a Safe Place Family Justice Center that we have in Clackamas County. She is partnered with an amazing young lady, Melissa Earlbaum, who is the director of Clackamas Women's Services, and I will say that these two women have really saved a tremendous amount of lives in our county, and I believe beyond that. The Family Justice Center is a place where domestic violence survivors and their children fleeing from intimate partner abuse can receive trauma-informed wraparound services from 10 on-site public and private partners that participate in the Family Justice Center. Services are free of charge. They include safety planning, assistance with filing protective orders, assessing emergency shelter, filing police reports, obtaining civil legal services, and supportive counseling. The Family Justice Center model is recognized as a national best practice for providing intervention services for domestic violence victims by the United States Department of Justice. We are the first and only Family Justice Center in Oregon, and I just want to commend Representative Leininger, and in her former role as our county commissioner, was integral in the creation of our Family Justice Center, which was opened in 2013. With her leadership, she really has made a difference. I want to tell you just about some of those numbers real quickly. Last year, 282 protective orders were processed at our Family Justice Center, and we saw over 4,000 visits for service. So I share with the committee today because I want you to understand that the director of our Family Justice Center, Angie Brandenburg, sees the everyday impact of intimate partner violence and the prevalence that we see at that program with strangulation cases. So I'd now like to turn it over to Angie.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lieutenant Angie Brandenburg with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and I'm also appearing today in support of House Bill 2955. I've had the honor of serving as the director of A Safe Place for the last 3 years, working closely with our public and private service partners in Oregon's First Family Justice Center, where we offer life-saving services for victims all in one place. As the sheriff said, the Family Justice Center model is recognized as the best practice model for providing intervention services for domestic violence victims. As a team of professionals, we recognize domestic violence homicides are both predictable and preventable. With that in mind, in 2014, we established a Safe Place multidisciplinary high-risk response team. This team is comprised of Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, investigators, jail, community corrections, the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office, prosecutors from the Domestic Violence Unit, and advocates with Victims Assistance Program, Clackamas Women's Services, and the Oregon Department of Human Services Child Welfare. The high-risk team works collaboratively to identify the most dangerous domestic violence offenders in our community, to hold those offenders accountable, while also importantly offering coordinated response to protect our victims. Strangulation is one of the highest factors when determining the potential for lethality in domestic violence cases. A study of our own high-risk cases for the last 2 years showed that 65% of our victims reported that they were strangled by their partner. And then I think it's important also to note that not everyone will report that they've been strangled as well. So that number is definitely on the low side. The short and long-term health effects of strangulation victims are harrowing. You've already heard that as well. Many of our victims report psychological issues such as PTSD, amnesia, psychosis, anxiety, depression. Many of our victims have survived unimaginable terror of strangulation along with other abuse. They oftentimes live under the power and control of their abuser. In many cases, the abuser doesn't strangle their partner to kill them. They strangle them to let them know they can take their life at any time they wish. Loss of consciousness can occur within 5 to 10 seconds. And oftentimes that means that the victim is strangled repeatedly to unconsciousness over a short period of time. I want to share with you just one quote of a former Family Justice Center client. Quote, "Actually, when I came out of that strangulation incident, I was more submissive, more terrified that the next time I might not come out, I might not make it. So I think I gave him all my power from there because I could see how easy it was for him to just take my life like he had given it to me," end quote. So thank you for the opportunity to testify here before you today, and I'd be happy to take any questions for you.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Thank you. Oh, you have one? Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Barker. So I understand the intent of this and so forth, and I think a couple of us signed on while people are testifying. We're like, oh, we like this. That's good news. While you were talking, I was thinking about the idea of strangulation by, you know, applying pressure to the chest in a sport that I can't personally bear to watch, but mixed martial arts fighting. where they intentionally pass out, you know, cause someone to pass out, how would, you know, if you include chest into strangulation, because to my understanding, I'm far from an expert on this, from, you know, they have rules about hitting in the throat and actually choking someone, but how would, you know, there are some leg holds that they intentionally cause somebody to pass out from, and would this incorporate or affect that? Well, no, but if you know them, I mean, there are, you know, mm-hmm. brothers that yeah. go do mixed martial arts together and that sort of thing. I'm saying is, I know it's kind of random and out there, but just would that, in, if assuming they knew one another, I'm not saying a close partner. Well, I'm reading the bill over and over.
Start on his own here.
Well, then tell me it doesn't apply in any way whatsoever. That'd be great.
Well, Chair Barker, Representative Stark. So I think that it's a matter of the elements of the crime, the intentionalness, and what the intent was of the perpetrator to the victim.
Okay. Thank you. You're welcome.
I just want to see him.
Okay.
I did please, go ahead. One quick one. Lieutenant, one thing just for people to understand, even when they've experienced substantial problems like this, it's normal, isn't it, for a person to have a hard time breaking away and that they may try several times. Is that correct?
Chair Barker and Representative Gorsuch, yes, it is true. I think it takes an average 7 times for a victim to leave a domestic violence relationship, and that's for the matter of power of control. There's a lot of, and Melissa Earlbaum with Clackamas Women's Services can speak more to this, but it's there's a lot of factors that are involved with leaving a relationship, and to the fact that the person fears for their life.
Right. And this is where I think we see like things like housing, you know, affordable housing, certainly dovetail with this, because even though it's already hard to leave, even under these circumstances, there may not be good places for them to go, especially with shelters being full.
Exactly, and that's where our services are so vital, because we can help folks who are still, you know, when they come to us, they don't have to file a police report. They can access our confidential services at the center and plan to leave those relationships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lieutenant.
Thank you. Representative Bile?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just want to know if we can get Sheriff Roberts an office here in the building. I've seen him here so often. I sure appreciate your help.
Thank
Sheriff,
you.
Thank you.
Crime must be rampant.
Yeah, one more, Representative.
Thank you both. I want to note how much leadership you've both shown in creating the Family Justice Center and helping us knit together all the partnerships so that all these services can be delivered effectively and efficiently under one roof. So I'm grateful to you for coming here to testify in support of the bill, but even more so grateful for your leadership, together with that of Melissa Earlbaum, Clackamas Women's Services, and others in the room for putting together the Family Justice Center. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I call Sybil Hibb and Melissa Earlbaum.
Go ahead. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson, Williamson, and members of the House Committee, I'm Melissa Earlbaum. You keep hearing my name. I'm not sure if I even need to come up here and say anything at this point, but I submitted written testimony, and I just want to highlight a couple of points from that, so not to repeat too much of what you've already heard. But I'm the Executive Director for Clackamas Women's Services, and I've been in this field for 20 years now. And what I can tell you is that survivors of non-fatal strangulation have known for years what we're only recently beginning to accept and understand, and that is that domestic violence offenders and rapists do not strangle their partners solely to kill them. They strangle them to let them know that they can kill them anytime they wish. And so when we talk about the increased penalties, this is an important point, because when we have survivors come forward and they say, I was strangled, I was choked, and we send them home, the perpetrator home, with a slap on the wrist with a misdemeanor, it just empowers the offender to become more and more violent and to use this crime again and again, often with greater force and also with greater consequence. Non-fatal strangulation has serious medical effects, as you've been hearing. It can cause internal hemorrhage, lacerations, miscarriages, chronic pneumonia, brain injury, etc. We know that these symptoms aren't easily recognized, and therefore it makes it harder to treat. For years, medical experts and researchers referred to strangulation assaults as attempted strangulation. The vast majority of strangulation or suffocation assaults are not attempts. They are completed criminal acts and should be prosecuted accordingly. Based on current research and the state of law, any intentional effort to apply pressure in order to impede airflow or blood flow should be viewed as a felony strangulation assault. There's also a correlation between perpetrators who strangle and the percentage by which they commit other crimes, including violence against law enforcement and mass homicides. Casey Gwynn from the Alliance of Hope International has a quote that I think is important. The next time you hear the phrase, "he choked me," make sure that gets your attention. The victim's abuser has just raised his hand and said, "I am a killer." The newly reauthorized Violence Against Women Act added strangulation and suffocation language to federal law for the first time, and the majority of states appropriately classify this dangerous and life-threatening crime as a felony. I strongly urge Oregon to take a stand and protect the lives of victims suffering from this daily horror. On behalf of Clackamas Women's Services, our board of directors, and the survivors we serve, I ask you to support HB 2955.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today, also in support of House Bill 2955. I really thank the sponsors of the bill and the committee for the attention, and I really am so appreciative of the efforts of all of the folks who've testified before me and who are in the room, who many of whom have been working on this since 2003 and before. From the Law Center's perspective, our mission is to help people achieve access to justice. A huge number of our clients come to us seeking safety from domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. And we're so concerned about these issues and so interested in the coordinated community response from our allies in the prosecution and in the victims' assistance offices and at the nonprofit support service providers, because these issues trap people in poverty. Domestic violence and sexual assault are a huge barrier to people being able to achieve their potential and being able to provide a safe place for themselves and for their families as they move forward in their attempts to have a just and safe existence. So that's why we're here in support of this bill. The current penalties of Class A misdemeanor are just completely out of whack with the severity and lethality of the behavior. And so one of our primary interests in this bill moving forward is that by enhancing the penalty to a Class C felony, we're raising public awareness. And we've seen law enforcement and prosecutors and others doing such a great job in trying to provide more training and better outreach. And that's made a difference. And we think this will also help. And the only thing that I would just additionally add is that Minnesota recently passed a felony upgrade to strangulation, and there was a survey that was conducted after the passage of the bill. One of the respondents, who is a judge, said, "This law is doing what we hoped it would do. It is drawing attention to the potential lethality of this crime. More resources and more training are being devoted to this type of case. We've increased the consequences, but also educated the public on the danger of domestic violence and strangulation." And that's our goal, and we really appreciate your help. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm going to take a second attempt at this question. Okay, so Sybil, I'm not trying to be complicated here. I'm actually trying to understand. So while we've been talking, I've read this bill several times, and I see it, you know, doing two different things. One is the domestic violence portion, which makes it, you know, the felony offense,
yes.
And that's in those specific. But as far as the, you know, ORS 163.187, which is cited, for all occasions of strangulation, it is changing the definition, whether it has to do with domestic violence or not. So the applying pressure to the chest, there are other things like mixed martial arts. I'm trying to figure out, is that going to cause people to have to change their fighting rules? How does that work?
So, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'll say one thing, and then you may want to ask a prosecutor. So I'm a civil attorney, so I don't do criminal law. But I think the two things that occurred to me, and I was chatting in the audience as you were asking your question, is I think that, number one, there's the issue of consent. If you're going into a fight and you're having, you know, it's the same thing comes up with boxing. Is that assault? It's not assault. It's not charged as assault. There's sort of, I imagine, a consent issue that comes up there, or that is sort of inherent in your coming into that situation. The other, so I guess that's the basic answer that I would have. If there are more specifics that you'd like, I think a prosecutor would be the better. Thanks.
Very good answer.
Thank you.
No, you're no, no. I mean, that was a good answer. That was a good question. Good answer.
How far am I going to the cage?
Yeah. Okay, well, close the public hearing on House Bill 2955 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2972, Representative, and call Senator Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2972 prohibits universities and colleges from threatening discipline or other sanctions to influence the decision of a victim of sexual assault, domestic violence, or stalking from reporting the incident or participating in the investigation or adjudication of the incident. House Bill 2972 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Representatives and Senator.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, ladies. I just assumed that the two of you would start since we're here in your committee. Hello, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. I am here today and encouraging you to pass House Bill 2972. And especially after hearing the previous bill, I really wish we were not here discussing such horrible, terrible things. So, unfortunately, we have heard that student experiences point to a need for a more specific directive from our state to say that public universities, community colleges, and private institutions cannot use threats of student discipline or sanctions against students to influence their decisions to report sexual assault, domestic violence, or stalking. We know college students are especially vulnerable to these types of these forms of violence, and as we work to support crime victims, it is unacceptable to further traumatize them through threats of discipline or sanction. Additionally, it is important that we send a message to perpetrators that their decision to commit these crimes is unacceptable. By allowing the victim to be the subject to these threats, the behavior of the perpetrator is supported as opposed to the needs of the victim. Sorry about that. I want to thank Representative Leininger and Representative Springer for working on this bill and for the Attorney General's office. Erin Knott, I believe, is here. I know there also are experts here today in the audience that can answer any of the specific questions. And I again want to thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee, and urge your support for House Bill 2972.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sherry Springer for the record, State Representative from House District 17. Oregon demonstrated our commitment to this issue in protecting the rights of survivors with the passage of House Bill 3476 in 2015, which expanded confidentiality rules to protect communications between victims, victim advocates, and a survivor. I'm pleased to co-sponsor this bill, and I believe this bill is the next step in making sure that Oregon has not just been just doesn't have good laws protecting sexual assault survivors on our campuses, but the best law. We have seen behavior from universities in other states which pressure survivors to participate in administrative investigations, whether they're comfortable in doing so or not. Oregon schools are not known to have engaged in this practice, and House Bill 2972 just makes sure they never will. This is not an issue that I necessarily anticipated I would be a part of a few years back. Having a son go to college, I started thinking about that process. And as we sent our son off many miles away to go to college, I worried about lots of things. I wonder what I would have worried about if he was a girl. I wonder if there'd be differences in that. And I want my son and all our students on a campus where there is absolutely a culture of total intolerance of any behavior that creates a victim for anybody.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, this is Ann Leininger, State Representative for Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. I'm really pleased to be here with my co-chief sponsors and thank Attorney General Rosenblum and Erin Knott and others who have supported this work. So this bill would make clear that survivors of sexual assault, of domestic violence, or stalking on a college campus do not have to participate in a disciplinary proceeding. They are protected from discipline for choosing not to involve themselves in a disciplinary proceeding related to their own assault, and that they will not expose themselves to discipline for having come forward. It's shocking that we actually need to do this bill, but there are many instances around the country in which people who've experienced sexual assault on campus and who come forward to report it get in trouble for alcohol code violations, get written up, get assigned 25 hours of community service because they are somehow in the wrong as people who have come forward. There was an incident at Columbia University where someone who was in a domestic violence intimate relationship was fighting back against her perpetrator in the hallway, and she got in trouble from the school. So there are odd situations in which victims can receive punishment, either because they declined to participate in a university-led disciplinary tribunal, they declined to come forward and be part of that adjudication-type process, or because they're perceived to have done something wrong to be in the situation that they're in the first place, sometimes related to alcohol. Now, what this bill makes clear is that that's not acceptable in Oregon, and it codifies essentially the understanding that that is emerging among all of our universities that our higher education institutions will not subject a victim to punishment, essentially because of their victimhood. Title IX requires that universities provide equal access to education for female students, that recipients of federal funding for education provide equal access for female students, and this bill essentially helps us fulfill that mission by making sure that people on campus, predominantly women who are victims of these kinds of crimes, are not going to be penalized for experiencing the crime or coming forward for the crime. There's a wonderful broad coalition in support of this bill, so with that, unless you have questions, we can hopefully hear from those who are even more enmeshed in the details. But we urge your support.
We'll start down the end here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm fascinated by this because I would have never anticipated the need for this. And let me make sure I understand it. A student is assaulted. He or she happens to be drunk at the time they were assaulted, and there's a rule that says you can't be drunk on this part of the campus. And now the authorities in the university are saying, look, if you don't drop this case, we're going to prosecute you for the drunken behavior in the wrong spot.
I can describe a couple scenarios to you where this has happened. It could be a scenario where you get in trouble for being drunk, which happens to be a violation of the honor code, and maybe the drunkenness was co-occurrent with the assault, but the idea of being penalized by getting hit for a violation of the honor code as a product of having come forward to disclose a sexual assault is one of the evils that the bill is intended to prevent. And then another is a situation where a victim may decline to want to prosecute a crime or you know, testify. Maybe they go to the clinic after they've suffered the crime, and the clinic personnel feel like they have to report it to the university personnel, and then the kid is called into some disciplinary tribunal to testify, and chooses not to testify, and because the person doesn't want to continue to be engaged in the issue, needs to have some space to recover, to decide how to proceed, and then they can get in trouble for that. So let me read just a couple of examples. In 2016, a student at a university in the Midwest reported rape and then indicated that she was targeted for investigation under the school's honor code. She reported being forbidden from enrolling in classes unless she cooperated with the investigation into her conduct in connection with the rape allegation. 12 students reported being investigated under the honor code after reporting sexual assault. In another school, in 2016, reports emerged of students who were pushed to accept alcohol conduct code violations after they reported sexual assault. One woman was sentenced to 25 hours of community service at a school in the Southeast. In 2013, a student faced expulsion for creating an intimidating environment for her ex-boyfriend when she went public about having been raped. She was told by the honor court that reporting her rape could violate the code, and then the domestic violence incident. And I know that Attorney Jackie Swanson has compiled a really quite a long list of reports in the media of similar scenarios around the country. And in order to prevent any ambiguity in the operation of school-based disciplinary systems in our publicly funded higher education institutions, we wanted to bring this bill to help make clear that people wouldn't get penalized for coming forward to disclose that they had been victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, or stalking, because we want to encourage people to come forward and get help when they need it and not create barriers for people getting help.
Okay. Thank you. And so, Representative
Stark? Thank you, Chair Barker. But Rep. Leininger did a fantastic job of answering my question.
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Here, as I read this, it doesn't talk about not using sanctions. It talks about not using the threat of sanctions. How do you enforce it? What's the mechanism for enforcing?
You know, I would.
Against using the threat.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I very much appreciate the question. What I would like to do, it's a very short bill, but what I'd like to do is allow our subsequent witnesses who are more closely involved with the drafting and line-by-line interpretation make sure that they give you exactly the right answer.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next call, Aaron Knott, Jackie Sandmeyer, and Laura Statham.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General and the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 2972. So as the previous panel indicated, House Bill 2972 is something that I hope will not and does not and should not apply to any systems of higher education in Oregon. Basically what this says, it's a very simple bill. It says you may not use either the threat of student discipline or other sanction to compel student participation in a disciplinary process related to sexual assault. Now, a lot of this comes back to
Mr. Chair, yes. It doesn't say either the threat or sanction. It says the threat of discipline or sanction.
May not use the threat of student discipline or other sanction.
Yeah, I assume that threat is referencing the two things. It's not either the threat or the sanction.
Well, that's something we'd be happy to clarify. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I guess I'd agree that it's ambiguous, but I hadn't read it that way initially, but we'd be happy to change it. So, Chair Barker, I'll continue, but point well taken. So, Chair Barker, to continue, a lot of this comes back from Title IX obligations that are imposed on our systems of higher education. When there's a colorable report of a sexual assault or other violation, they have an affirmative obligation to perform an investigation of that allegation of assault. But, of course, that only goes so far. And again, in Oregon, this isn't conduct we've seen, but in some other schools across the country, we have seen schools taking the additional step of saying, if you don't comply with this education, we will refer you to an honor code violation or similar violation. Those high-pressure tactics essentially take away from our sexual assault victims the ability to have any ownership over their own decision about how their narrative goes forward. Here in Oregon, we have established, I think, a national model for recognizing the need for trauma-informed care and advocacy options for our victims of sexual assault, especially in our college campuses. We have seen bills of this kind spring up in other states, and if Oregon is going to continue to be what I think the real model that we are, this is necessary here as well. If you look on OLIS, you'll see testimony from the various categories of schools that we have here in Oregon, community colleges, public universities, private colleges, all essentially saying the same thing. This is a best practice. This is what we should be doing now. Codifying this in statute simply guarantees that we won't see the kinds of incidents we've seen in other states in Oregon. And I would submit that the Baylors, the Pace Universities, the Brigham Youngs that we have been hearing about, the complaints to the Department of Education that have been made of victims saying, I was told if I didn't go along with what the school wanted, I would be subjected to discipline, represent the tip of a larger iceberg. Most victims that are subjected to that threat of sanction will never never end up in the newspaper. Their identities will never be known. But with a simple Google search, you can find more than ample justification for the reason we need to make this clarification in Oregon law. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll just say thank you for offering to straighten out the language. We know ambiguous language will end up in the Court of Appeals, and who knows how they will interpret it later. So,
Chair Barker, that's something of a full employment act for the Department of Justice, but I'll do it anyway.
I want to thank Representative Greenlick for catching that, too. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jackie Sandmeyer. I'm the campus coordinator for the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 2972 as it promotes what we know to be best practices on our college campuses here in Oregon. In my role at the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force, I provide technical assistance to all public, private, four-year, and two-year colleges and universities around best practices and compliance of Title IX. Through this work, myself as well as the task force, we strive to find what is sometimes a very delicate balance between federally mandated compliance of Title IX and Clery Act with what we know to be victim-centered and trauma-informed and what in all reality serves our students best. 1 in 5 women will experience sexual violence while enrolled in a college here in the state of Oregon. And additionally, our students of marginalized populations, our LGBT students, as well as our students from communities of color, will experience rates of sexual violence that are so high it's unparalleled by their peers. Title IX asks that colleges investigate all known instances of sexual harassment, which since then in case law has been expanded to include sexual violence, domestic violence, and stalking as well. Now, this call to investigate and adjudicate complaints on campuses is to be weighed with a student victim's request around confidentiality, as well as the request that's sometimes made from students of whether or not that case should even move forward. Students often identify embarrassment, fear of retaliation, and most of all, fear of the unknown, a very complex, thick federal compliance law and the systems that have to do with Title IX as reasons for why they don't come forward after an assault. We know that if students are given confidential options and empowered to make decisions on how to move forward, they'll, one, be more likely to seek out support services, but secondly, we've also seen that they're more likely to choose to make an official report after the assault happens. Since the implementation of House Bill 3476, which led to privileged communication and has been alluded to by other folks around this bill, it for the first time gave students in the state of Oregon a confidential option to find out what their options were, what services were available to them. And in just the year of implementation since that bill has passed and we've implemented it on our college campuses, we've seen a 120% increase in students deciding to report. We've also seen a 138% increase in students who have decided to access confidential support services on our college campuses in Oregon. Now, that's nationally unprecedented. Title IX affords certain rights and protections that students rely upon when making the decision of whether or not they want to come forward after an assault. Now, it's the language that students receive in those Know Your Rights trainings, whatever documents that the school provides them of their rights, their options, services provided to them, that are really the platform for when students decide and find solace in the fact that their college or university will support them through what can sometimes be a traumatizing process. To risk any student fearing that their institution may sanction them or threaten to take action against them after reporting an assault goes against everything we know to be best practice. Oregon is considered the model in the country for some of the best victim-centered Title IX compliant programs in the nation. And this bill should be no different. Much of what we have to thank is the Attorney General's Office for their unwavering commitment behind crime victims in Oregon, as well as this legislature for passing things such as House Bill 3476. So I urge the passage of Senate Bill 2972 to help Oregon take yet another step in the right direction towards trauma-informed best practices, and most of all toward ensuring our students that they will always be met with compassionate responses post-disclosure of something that will probably be the most traumatizing event in their college career. Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura? Hi. Chairman Barker, members of the Judiciary Committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and testify on House Bill 2972. My name is Laura Statham. I am OHSU's Title IX Coordinator and Associate Director for the Affirmative Action Equal Opportunity Department. I'm here today to express OHSU's support for the bill and the climate it supports for students at Oregon universities to be able to report instances of sexual assault, sex and gender harassment, and discrimination. This bill reflects what OHSU policy practice, policy and practice already are. We work to create an atmosphere that is safe and supportive. We're committed to policies that create a safe space for students to report sexual assault. Students afraid to come forward are reassured that they will be supported in their decision if they decide to pursue a complaint. SB 2972 would help institutions further cement that message with students. We respond swiftly to all reports of these incidents and work to provide support services for those who have experienced sexual or relationship violence or stalking and sexual assault. We protect the rights of OHSU members under our Title IX obligations, apply our code of conduct harassment and discrimination policies, and cooperate fully with law enforcement. OHSU works with partners across our institution to ensure that students have information about support, resources, services, and assistance that the university will provide, including academic, working, and transportation accommodations, health and counseling services, and referrals to legal advocacy or law enforcement. We work to assist and connect students to services and resources in accordance with that student's choice. OHSU is committed to providing students an informed choice of whether or not they decide to move forward. In short, we try to be present, helpful, and understanding of what can be done during what, as Jackie said, is the most difficult time in their life and academic career. We support this legislation as another way to ensure that those students receive the support they need from their university when they most need it. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Any questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Is this the right panel to ask what the enforcement mechanism is for this era? Is that here?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I think there will be some others that can take a stab at this, but I'll take a stab at it as well.
You can leave that question on the table there for anybody else to pick up.
I can take it.
I can do the federal.
So the interesting part about this bill is we're at an intersection of a state amplification of a federal requirement. So Title IX has a provision that says no institution should do any act towards a student that would qualify as retaliation. What's interesting about that provision is it was never written into the original Title IX law. It was later added as a guidance document to Title IX from the U.S. Department of Education. So there is technically a provision in a guidance document from USDOE that says no institution shall retaliate against a student. And there is an example given that says sanctioning a victim post coming forward and reporting an assault would qualify as retaliation. But it's much harder for students to find protections in written guidance documents than it would be if Oregon were to take the step to actually make it law, which would then follow all Title IX requirements and would not put our schools in any way outside of compliance, but would instead give our student victims an added layer of protection at universities here in Oregon.
I can follow up?
Follow up.
I was wondering whether this would give a personal right of action to a student for the violation of this.
Yeah, so Title IX affords students a private right of action under Title IX, so they can make an individual report to the U.S. Department of Education, aside from whatever hearing or adjudication process they're proceeding with through the institution. So I think this would give clearer language and probably a more clear right of action for a student to pursue a federal complaint against a university.
Well, could they also sue the university in state court under this statute?
Take a swing at that. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, if a university doesn't follow their own conduct code in the imposition of discipline or some other action against a student, that can give rise to litigation. And conduct codes are required to follow both state and federal law. So I do think this is going to have the effect of moving the goalposts potentially in both state and federal litigation. If the schools do this, their conduct code is definitely going to say now that they can't. They have to comply with state law. So I do think this will be helpful on that level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank that you. Helps.
Okay, thank you. Anything further questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Next we'll call Audrey True Rural. Brenda Tracy and Jackie Swanson.
Whoever wants to choose to go first, go ahead, and don't forget to identify yourself.
All right. Even though Chair Barker has left the room temporarily.
You know, I can assure you he'll be back.
Okay. To him, Vice Chairs Olson, Williamson, and members of the committee, my name is Marjorie Trueblood Gamble, and I am the Director of Diversity and Inclusion and Title IX Coordinator of Southern Oregon University, and I'm here to provide comments to the proposed House Bill 2972. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. The letter that you should have received electronically is a letter that comes from the Title IX coordinators of the Oregon Public Universities that reiterates our deep commitment to preventing and responding to sexual misconduct and violence, as well as providing support to survivors. In that letter, we highlighted a general sense of what this commitment looks like through the development of comprehensive prevention programs, providing equitable and neutral investigations, and ensuring that victims and survivors have access to confidential resources that can provide them a range of options. I signed the letter because in my role as Title IX coordinator or otherwise, I have not and would not sanction or threaten to sanction a victim to compel them to participate in an investigation. That is not how we operate. In fact, we have already received guidance from the Office of Civil Rights in the questions and answers on Title IX and sexual violence document, where there's a hyperlink in that letter. It was published in 2014, and it states, if the school determines that it can respect the student's request not to disclose his or her identity to the alleged perpetrator, it should take all reasonable steps to respond to the complaint consistent with the request. Although a student's request to have his or her name withheld may limit the school's ability to respond fully to an individual allegation of sexual violence, other means may be available to address the sexual violence. I think it is important for you to know that at SOU, we have been recognized for our Title IX response on the state, regional, and national levels. We have received commendations from the accrediting body NWCCU. We garnered praise from Senator Wyden, who stated SOU is leading the nation in response to sexual assault. And our confidential advisor, Angela Fleischer, has testified in our nation's capital on what campus sexual assault response best practices entail in 2014. We have received these commendations and others because we believe it is possible to be survivor-centered and Title IX compliant. And we do this by following a program we call Campus Choice. While I won't go into detail of all 14 points or elements of the program, I would like to highlight a few to demonstrate what our victim-centered approach looks like. Element 9, reasonable efforts will be made to meet the needs of the victim and address any barriers the victim faces when participating in sexual assault investigations with campus and law enforcement. Element 10, after making a report, a victim or reporting party will not be pressured to participate or not participate in an administrative or criminal investigation. Element 11, after a formal report is given, no involved party shall be required to attend the administrative hearing. Element 12, when reporting to a confidential advisor, a victim's right to confidentiality shall be respected. Title IX is about equity, and equity is about the Platinum Rule. Most of you may be familiar with the Golden Rule. Treat people the way you would like to be treated. The Platinum Rule is treat people the way they want to be treated, not assuming we know what is best for them, and certainly not forcing them into processes that will not fully support what they need. Thank you for the time, and if you have any questions, or maybe I should wait.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. And we are going to start running up against the time problem, so I'd ask you to. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jacqueline Swanson. I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 2972. 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted while in college, according to one of the most recent widely cited campus sexual assault studies conducted by the NIJ.
Another report from United Educators found, among other things, that 90% of those victims who were assaulted on campus knew the perpetrator. 60% of the sexual assaults occurred on campus. 41% involved off-campus parties. 78% involved alcohol. 3 out of 4 of those victims were freshmen or sophomores in college, and 40% delayed reporting by almost a year. These factors highlight the need to educate and change the culture, not only to prevent sexual assault from occurring in the first place, but to create an atmosphere where victims feel safe in coming forward. While some victims may decide to report incidents to police, the majority of them do not, and others may feel they should turn to the university first for help or recourse. As you've heard testimony here today, under federal law, a school is obligated to act when it knows or reasonably should know that one of its students has been sexually assaulted. Furthermore, a school is charged with providing a safe learning environment for all students, which includes giving victims the help needed to help reclaim their education. Despite this, unfortunately, colleges and universities across the nation have elected to threaten and retaliate against survivors who decide to participate or not participate, as the case may be, in campus investigations and disciplinary proceedings. For example, if a student comes forward to makes a report of sexual assault to their campus administrators because they want to seek resources that are available on campus and later decide they do not want to go through the disciplinary process, the victim should not then be sanctioned for making, quote unquote, a false report as evidenced by their unwillingness to proceed in disciplinary actions. We don't hold this standard for victims who come forward and report to police, and we shouldn't do it in campus proceedings either. Indeed, at least one other state, Maryland, has adopted a law that's very similar to this one. It was passed in 2015, and it is HB 571, in case you would like to look at that. Many of these incidents go unreported due in no small part to the fact that many victims choose not to come forward at all because of the fear that they will face discipline or retaliation as a result. This creates a systemic unwillingness or barrier for victims to come forward and access these resources for fear that they're going to be punished. This not only compounds the trauma of sexual assault survivors, but allows perpetrators to escape accountability. For all of these reasons and more, I urge you to pass HB 2972. Thank you.
Hi, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy. I am a rape survivor. Just over 2 years ago, I came forward with my story of in 1998 when I was drugged and gang raped by 4 college football players. 2 of those players went to Oregon State University. Since then, I've become an advocate, and I have traveled the country working with different universities, mainly athletic programs. This is a real thing. I hear from multiple survivors from all over the country, including our own state, that they come forward and then are told whether or not they want to participate or not. It can go both ways. But many times come forward and, you know, were you drinking? Well, you could be, you know, have an honor code violation and you could be kicked out of school. So then the victim doesn't want to participate or doesn't want to do anything. And the coercion can go both ways, to report or not report. And I think we should really point out that, you know, this is a national discussion right now. We're talking about it now, but what about in 5 years if we're not talking about it anymore? Legislation protects our future generations of students, and we are obligated to do that. We already know that we have lived under decades of shame and silence, and we must stop that, and we can do that with legislation. And I think legislation is necessary, especially for college universities, because while I understand that there may be one office on campus that is advocating for students and doing the right thing, maybe another office isn't. And with, you know, speaking in the sports arena, I haven't seen any change in the sports area. And I will tell you that when a student comes forward to make a report against an athlete, where, you know, universities, you know, money is everything and sports is everything. When a woman comes forward to make a report against an athlete, there absolutely is an agenda on the university's part to not want to deal with that. And so these students are being threatened with disciplinary action because they don't want the scandal of an athlete being involved. This happens at Baylor. It happens everywhere. And so for me, working in this arena, specifically working in the football arena, I see some changes in some areas on our campuses that we're doing better. But when it comes to sports, we're just not. We're not doing better yet. And this law lets our universities know that regardless of who the person is reporting, regardless of who the perpetrator is. Everyone deserves to be treated fairly and equally in the processes on our campuses. Everyone deserves equal protection on our campuses, regardless of who the victim is and who the perpetrator is. This helps ensure that. And I'm happy to hear that the universities here in Oregon aren't doing this. And if they're not, then they shouldn't have a problem with this legislation because they're not breaking the law or violating it. So it really should be kind of a non-issue. So I urge you to support this bill and protect our students and our future generations of students. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Thank you very much. Melissa Erlbaum, Sybil Hibb, and Missy Metella. And again, we have additional bills, so we do.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Melissa Erlbaum, the executive director for Clackamas Women's Services, and I am here in support of this as a service provider that provides support for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. We believe it's wildly important that we ensure a survivor's agency and their ability to recover in a way that makes sense for them and to determine if, when, and how they will talk about an event. Administrative processes that re-traumatize a survivor by taking away the ability to make critical decisions is unacceptable, and that's why we're here as a service provider to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and the committee. My name is Missy Metella. I'm the Assistant General Counsel at the University of Oregon. I have a wide practice there, but I do focus on prohibited discrimination and Title IX matters. I work closely with our Title IX coordinator, who also signed on to the letter that you heard the SOU Title IX coordinator talk about as well. University of Oregon also submitted some written testimony, and I'll read parts of it. I'm also happy to answer questions and to talk about what I'd also really like to talk about is how the University of Oregon protects the agency of survivors and the confidentiality that we offer on campus at this point. So just starting briefly with the top of my testimony, the University of Oregon is committed to ensuring that all of its students are able to fully and equally access their education free from sexual harassment, including acts of sexual violence, domestic violence, and gender-based stalking. U of O is also committed to ensuring that its process designed to implement this policy is neutral, fair, compassionate, and consistent with the Office for Civil Rights and Best Practices. Based on those principles, it has never issued sanctions against a survivor for refusing to participate in the university's process relating to an underlying incident of sexual violence. And further, when at all possible, it honors a request of confidentiality for the survivor. I think it's also maybe important here to talk about University of Oregon's practices related to confidentiality on campus. We have two advocates that are not only social workers, but also now have the certified advocate privilege. They are confidential resources, and they also are able to offer interim accommodations to our students. That means that our survivors of sexual assault can go to a confidential resource, receive academic accommodations or other accommodations necessary to make sure that they're still able to access their education, all through a confidential resource. Students also have the choice if they would like to report to the university, and even at that point, they can still make the decision to say, I want to remain confidential or I don't want any action. The University of Oregon goes through the process is actually outlined in some of the testimony that I submitted to you and goes off of OCR best practice, talking about, is there a repeat offender? Is there physical force? But in all cases, it's possible they honor the request of the victim. If the University of Oregon cannot honor the request of the victim because there is some sort of threat to its campus community, that person is then deemed in our process a non-participating complainant. And while that person retains certain rights, so for example, that person could still appeal the decision at the end of the administrative process, and they could still review some of the reports, so they have certain rights. They have no obligation. They're not punished in any way. They don't have to participate. They have the rights, but not the duty to participate or be a part of the process. Those are some of the things that we're doing right now to protect the confidentiality of survivors on campus. Recently, in response to this bill, there was some discussions with the University of Oregon about the fact that its current process was unclear. And so I also wanted to provide this memorandum to show we've never been doing that practice, but to the extent there wasn't clarity around the process, that we were willing to make changes and we did them quickly. So we're hopeful with these changes, it's very clear what University of Oregon's practice has been and will be in the future, and its strong commitment to confidentiality.
thank you, and please let me know if you have any questions that I can help with.
Thank you. Okay, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center in support of House Bill 2972. I really appreciate the efforts of the sponsors to bring this forward, and I'll make my remarks very brief. I echo the concerns and support that others have stated, and I'll just add two quick points. One is that for students on campus, everything is at risk without confidentiality and privacy. Educational achievement in addition to safety, and that's really the equivalent of opportunity and future success. And so this is really important to making sure that people can move forward in achieving as they intend in going to college at that vulnerable time. I know we have great partners on campuses, and many people, many of whom have testified before me, are on campus and working daily to make sure to preserve people's confidentiality. The clear benefit to this bill is that it codifies in statute this protection, and that sends the most important message possible to survivors, and it will ensure that people are able to come forward and get the help that they need. So we really appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Collard Tower.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm really proud to be part of this team of amazing advocates fighting for this legislation. A number of our members fight for the rights of victims of sexual abuse and assault in the civil justice system, and we also support this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm happy to answer or duck any of your questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Tower? Thank you.
Thank you.
And then we'll close the public hearing. We'll get an amendment back before we move that on to clarify the language. And next, I'm going to jump out of order and open a public hearing on House Bill 3176 and call Representative Williamson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3176 provides that in determining mitigation for purposes of imposing sentence, a court may consider whether the defendant committed the crime while being commanded or urged by or under pressure or influence from another person who has committed acts of domestic violence against the defendant.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I am the state representative for House District 36 on the west side of Portland. You've heard me over and over come to this committee trying to ferret out the reason that our women's prison population has grown exponentially in the last 40 years. According to government statistics, the number of women in prison has increased 700% since 1980. And in Oregon, we have nearly 46,000 women behind bars or on probation. Nationwide, the number of women in prison in the United States who attribute their incarceration to a relationship with a batterer is staggering. As of 2003, it was between 80 and 85% of women. Further, 79% of women in federal and state prisons reported being victims of abuse. As these statistics show, many women who are being incarcerated are victims of violence, coercion, and abuse. And as we heard earlier today on other bills, domestic violence is really about power and control. Victims are terrorized by their abusers. And in many cases, we may be adding to the overall harm to these women and their children by not taking this abuse into account. I believe we can better serve the cause of justice by allowing judges to consider whether domestic violence or abuse in the sentencing process. This bill authorizes the court to consider whether a person who committed a crime was commanded or coerced to do so by a person who has committed domestic violence against them. And I'm entering an amendment to add sex trafficking to this bill as well. So under the current state law, the court shall consider in the sentencing phase any evidence received during the proceeding, the pre-sentence report when available, and other evidence related to aggravation or mitigation that the court finds trustworthy and reliable. The court may also consider the defendant's status as a service member. While the courts currently have considerable latitude in considering a variety of factors during the sentencing phase, there is nothing in statute that specifically guides the court to consider domestic violence and, with the amendment, sex trafficking. And I believe the impact of this violence on victims is serious enough that the court should consider it in its sentencing phase.
So this bill would ensure that these issues that are very important and we know prevalent in women in our criminal justice system be part of the consideration of their punishments when convicted of a crime. So I thank you for your time and your consideration, and I urge us to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Okay. Call Aaron Greenwald, Deanna Horn, and Julia Yoshimoto. You can go ahead in any order. Just remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson and Williamson, my name is Aaron Greenwald. Again, I represent the Oregon Department of Justice in support of this bill, House Bill 3176 and or a -1 amendment that sounds like it's coming. As I said earlier, I'm the domestic violence resource prosecutor, and so it might at first blush seem odd that a prosecutor might stand up here or rather sit up here in support of mitigating factors for a defendant. But part of what I'm tasked with quite specifically, and you've heard others laud the efforts of the Department of Justice in terms of working on behalf of victims, is part of what I do is I seek to improve the criminal justice system and how it responds to domestic violence. And we feel that 3176 does that. House Bill 3176 proposes, as you heard Rep. Williamson say, to amend 137090, which specifically would allow courts to consider as mitigating evidence information whether the defendant committed the crime while being commanded or urged by or under pressure or influence from another person who has committed acts of domestic violence. And that phrase has a very specific definition within 135230, and it's very commonly used. Domestic violence, whether you're using that definition that we use in the criminal code or the more colloquial understanding of that term, is far too prevalent nationally. And I won't go on and on about the statistics, but 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men nationally have been victims of domestic violence. Here in Oregon, almost 1/3 of women have reported experiencing some kind of domestic violence. Already this year in Oregon, we've suffered 16 deaths related to domestic violence, and last year there were 37 Oregonians who lost their lives because of domestic violence. So the statistics are as overwhelming as domestic violence itself, but the consequences we know are unified in their conclusion, which is that it's an epidemic with tragic and long-lasting consequences, which brings me to sort of the policy underpinnings of the bill and why we sit in support of it here today. As Rep. Williamson said, domestic violence is about power and control, but it's also about perpetrators creating barriers through this power and control. And the result of those barriers, which keeps victims from leaving or telling anybody about what's going on, is that they have no perceived options. And this is particularly true when a victim has been threatened, coerced, pressured, or in some way otherwise involved in a criminal activity. And at that point, they're truly trapped in sort of this Hobson's choice of what do I do? An Oregon study from some time ago found that 56% of the female inmate population reported that they had committed their charging crime to please their partner. 45% said they had committed a crime to obtain drugs for their partner, and 40% that their charging crime was actually committed by their partner. And there are numerous other studies that show a large percentage of females who are imprisoned have been victims of domestic violence, and that but for the coercive control exhibited by the perpetrator, many of those women would not have committed the crimes and thus not be incarcerated. As Rep. Williamson said, there exists statute already and administrative rules which allows for wide latitude of the courts to take into consideration as might be put forward through this bill. However, this would recognize, House Bill 3176 would recognize the varied and often tragic consequences of domestic violence. I think this proposal reflects an evolution of thinking and understanding about domestic violence, which is what our laws should do, which serve as a mirror to current societal standards. I do think that the bill could be written just a bit more clearly to incorporate some of the existing law. A couple of suggestions might be that we change it to indicate that
evidence regarding defendant's status as a domestic violence can be considered, or whether domestic violence perpetrated against the defendant contributed to defendant's commission of the crime, or whether defendant acted under the duress, compulsion, direction, or pressure of a person who has committed or threatened to commit domestic violence, as defined in either 135230 or 107705, which is the FAPA restraining order statute, which is slightly different. In either form or fashion, we urge your support, and I thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Williamson, again, thank you for this bill, Representative Williamson. My name is Deanna Horn. I work for Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. I am a career public defender. I'm also here speaking for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association in support of this bill. My role really is, I guess, to inform you and to tell you how this would work in my everyday practice, and to share with you some stories of women that I have represented and their tragic circumstances that led them to prison. While the courts now can consider a large number of mitigating factors, and as a criminal defense attorney, I do my best to flesh out my client's stories and to tell them to a court so that they can understand the person that's standing in front of them. But when direction from the legislature comes to the judicial branch and says, you know, we think this is really important, that the person standing in front of you has been a victim of domestic violence, we recognize that that is going to inform the way that that person sees the rest of the world and the way they operate in the world, that holds a lot of sway over the judiciary. I have represented women who have been victims of sex trafficking, who at the behest of their abuser, their trafficker, the person who has threatened them and has harmed them and has injured them, looks at them and tells them to go and traffic someone else. I have defended that woman in front of a court and had that woman sentenced to prison for trafficking someone else at the behest of her abuser. And that's not okay. I've had the district attorney in these cases look at me and tell me, well, I understand she's been a victim of violence and abuse, and I understand that she's been raped, but she did the crime. She needs to go and pay for it now. I represented a woman who whose abuser broke her hip 3 months before I was appointed, and they were living on the streets, and the life in the streets for women is very violent, even without a violent romantic partner. He sent her out from their camp one morning and told her that she had better come back with a particular brand of shampoo before he saw her that evening, or else. He had already broken her hip. This had been years of violence. Not having any money, she attempted to panhandle to get the money to buy the shampoo. She finally went to the Walgreens and shoplifted it, and when she was confronted at the doorway by the Walgreens employees, she pulled a knife to escape because she knew that if she was just cited for shoplifting and went back without the shampoo that she'd been sent after, she didn't know what was going to happen, but it wasn't going to be good. And she wasn't going to be safe. And so she went to prison for a robbery. My office has handled countless cases, absolutely countless cases, where women are caught with a boy delivery level of drugs that rise to a level where they couldn't use them all themselves. The law allows the district attorney's office to send them to prison for delivery. When the person that really had those drugs was a violent partner, and when the police showed up, those drugs ended up in my client's property, in her bag or in her lap or under her feet in a car in several occasions. And those women go to prison for burglary. And what I sometimes hear from prosecutors is, well, yeah, we get it. This is violent and terrible, but she needs to go to prison. Clear communication from this body to the Oregon judiciary that this is something you take seriously. This is something we really need to consider when we look at people's stories and consider them as individuals goes a long way. So we urge an aye vote.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Julia Yoshimoto, and I'm an attorney and project director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. The Oregon Justice Resource Center is a nonprofit public interest law firm located in Portland, Oregon, that works to address unmet legal needs of justice-involved individuals and works for criminal justice reform in Oregon. I'm the director of the OJRC's Women in Prison Project, and the goals of the Women in Prison Project are to ensure that our criminal justice system treats women fairly, keeps them safe, and works to help them successfully rejoin their communities and families when they are released from incarceration. Through my work, I assist women who are incarcerated at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility and work with women who are formerly incarcerated. And I have the opportunity to hear a lot about their circumstances and what was going on for them around the time of the commission of their crimes. And it is not uncommon for me to hear that the an abusive relationship, domestic violence, was a significant contributing factor to the reason that they committed those crimes. I hear a wide range of stories from women who, in self-defense, committed crimes against an abusive partner. I often hear stories about women who feel threatened, pressured, coerced by an abusive partner to commit a crime, to be at the scene of a crime, in which they are then caught up, charged, and convicted. I spoke with one woman who had no prior criminal record, no involvement with the criminal justice system before going into Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, was involved in a relationship. At that time, she had steady employment, was mothering her minor children. The relationship turned into an abusive relationship. Her partner began committing property offenses related to his drug addiction. And as a result of the physical violence, the threats that she received from him, the sense of feeling trapped and afraid in this relationship, she got caught up in assisting him in those property crimes, was charged and convicted, and sentenced to close to 10 years in prison. This is a common story that we hear at the Oregon Justice Resource Center, and this is an issue that we have been looking into more. And we feel like this bill is a notable step toward recognizing that domestic violence is a significant contributing factor to the reason that women intersect with the criminal justice system and involved in the criminal justice system, and we urge your support.
Thank you. Bill. Any questions? Thank you very much. Just want to close the public hearing on House Bill 3176 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2988.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2988 classifies the crime of harassment involving offensive physical contact as a Class A misdemeanor and a person crime when it's committed in the presence of a minor child or stepchild of, or a minor child residing with, the defendant or victim. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mary Sell and Gina Skinner, please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name again is Gina Skinner. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Washington County, and I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of House Bill 2988. This bill, in essence, is increasing the penalty for the crime of harassment under certain circumstances. Currently, the crime of harassment with the physical offensive touching is a B misdemeanor, and what this would be doing is taking the language that's currently in the assault 4 and the strangulation bill that's currently an enhancement. that indicates that the crime has either been witnessed by or is committed in the immediate presence of a minor child of either the victim, the defendant, or a minor child that lives within the household. Harassment is a crime that is very frequently charged in domestic violence cases. You've probably heard in this session or in other sessions issues associated with the term physical injury. This crime does not require the state to prove physical injury, but it does require an intentional mental state. So this is not; these are not accidental events. As reference to some of the questions that we had in our previous bills today, this is it has to have an intentional criminal mental state to intend to harass or annoy, to subject, intend to subject another person to offensive physical touching. Those type of cases tend to be things such as slapping, hitting, hair pulling, grabbing around your throat that doesn't quite rise to the level of strangulation, hitting somebody with an object, foot stomping, shoving into objects, arm twisting, headbutting, everything that just does not quite rise to the level of physical injury. Or at trial, the state will frequently charge somebody with both assault in the fourth degree and harassment, because oftentimes the assault for is the defendant is either found not guilty or judgment of acquittal is granted because that legal standard of physical injury is not proven. To be able to prove physical injury, the state has to prove impairment of somebody's physical condition or substantial pain. One could have a black eye, bruising, swelling, or pain that's for less than a substantial amount, and still you would not rise to the level of physical injury. The dynamics associated with committing the crime of harassment against a domestic partner are the same as we've been hearing all afternoon associated with power and control and domestic violence. So the issue that we're trying to address here is, should there be somewhat of a more significant penalty when this is occurring in front of children? And there has been significant studies, and there has been testimony going all the way back to 1997 when the original assault four statute was enhanced to a C felony under circumstances where it was witnessed by a minor child, that there are long-term detrimental effects to children who are exposed to domestic violence. And this is needs to be recognized in the law. This will not make it a felony. This will only make it an A misdemeanor as a person's crime. And the only reason that is relevant, there's a couple of reasons. One, some counties that do formally supervise misdemeanors will only formally supervise A misdemeanors. There are very few counties that will formally supervise B misdemeanors. So again, this will allow for those counties, these individuals, to have a formal supervision with a probation officer and domestic violence treatment that is monitored by the court. Second of all, as a distinction as an A misdemeanor person's crime, if you have two convictions or two incidences where that's happened in your past, and the violence is continuing, and the violence escalates to the point that you do commit a felony crime, whether it's an assault for or a strangulation against in that family circumstance, then that could be, those A misdemeanors could potentially lead somebody to be eligible that they could go to prison. Not to say that they would, but it would give that option. But again, that would be basically your third strike in this scenario. And so under the current law, if you commit B misdemeanors, you could commit B misdemeanors over and over and over and over again, and that reflects that you have no criminal history on the criminal history score. You could have an infinite number of B misdemeanors, and your criminal history score would be zero. And so this would eventually give some criminal history if someone were to escalate and start committing felonies against their partner. So for those reasons, members of the committee, Chair Barker, the Oregon District Attorney Association would strongly encourage the passage of House Bill 2988.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mary Sell. I am legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here to essentially highlight some concerns that OCDLA has about 2988. There are essentially three points that I want to make, and I know that we're running short on time, and so I'll be brief. The first is the sentencing ramifications. And so as you actually did hear from Ms. Skinner just a moment ago,
There is a possibility down the road, if someone is convicted of two Class A person misdemeanors, to have a pretty serious, significant criminal history. Essentially, under the Oregon sentencing guidelines, for every two Class A person misdemeanors that a person has, it essentially counts against them down the road as a one person felony. That's a significant jump, going from having two misdemeanors on your record to having some kind of situation down the line where you're going to be subjected to incredibly enhanced sentencing. It's a concern that we have. We wanted to highlight that for the committee. Ultimately, we know that it's up to this legislative body to decide whether or not that's a decision that you want to make in this context, but we did want to highlight that for you. As far as the second point goes, we do understand that based on testimony here today from Skinner and also based on essentially the context of all of the bills that you heard today, that likely this is getting at domestic violence. The concern that we have is the way that this bill is written, it's not targeting domestic violence only. It is saying that any type of harassment committed in the presence of either party's minor child is going to be elevated. That's overbroad without narrowing language. You can imagine that possibly there are two people having a tussle in the parking lot. This is a harassment. It does require, based on the way that this law is written, physical contact, but there's no physical injury, and so we're still talking about a lower type of crime. We're not talking about an assault, but we are talking about offensive physical contact. You could imagine two people having a bad day, get into a tussle in the parking lot. No one's been injured. There's no injury, but possibly one of these people has their child in the backseat of their car, possibly unbeknownst to the charged actor. This is just one example of a few that we can think of. And so when we're talking about how is this law actually going to impact people, is it really going to be focused only on domestic violence situations? And I think the answer is no, based on our reading. And so we wanted to highlight that for you. Lastly, we are concerned about immigration consequences. I myself am not an immigration lawyer, but over the past 5 years, one of the things that I've had to focus on is how are criminal convictions going to affect my clients? And so in order for me to do my due diligence, I've always reached out to immigration attorneys. We have uploaded testimony from a law professor named Carrie Leonetti, who teaches constitutional law, and a crimigation class. And so that's the intersection of immigration law and criminal law at the University of Oregon. She's uploaded testimony kind of explaining what our position is. But to boil it down, based on the knowledge that I have and based on the information that she's provided, anytime there's a crime of violence where there's a possibility of a year in jail, this is under immigration law, which is incredibly complex, considered a aggravated felony. So even though this is only a misdemeanor and this law is only trying to essentially move this from a Class B misdemeanor up to a Class A misdemeanor, under immigration law, this could be considered, and we believe would be considered, an aggravated felony. The reason why that matters is anytime someone is essentially convicted of an aggravated felony, they are deportable. And they're also inadmissible. And what that means is they're never again allowed to come back to the United States. And it would also give them, it would essentially interfere with their ability to present any type of immigration defense. And so I will ask that you do look at the letter from Professor Leonetti regarding that third concern.
Thank you. So I have a bill that's going to take care of the 365-day issue.
And we love that. Thank you so much, Chair Barker.
And then I would also just say, how many times do you think somebody should be able to assault before you move it up? I mean, isn't like the first time. And I see, I mean, we try to keep people out of trouble as much as we can. We're trying to make way for the woman who's been abused and forced to do something. But at some point, you know, somebody keeps... especially violent crime has a victim, it's hard to get too sympathetic about
Chair Barker, I appreciate the comment that you've made, but what I guess the comment that I have based on the bill that's in front of us right now, we're not talking about a second or third time. We're talking about on the first time that someone is being charged with harassment, it's elevating it to a Class A misdemeanor. And so I absolutely understand, and OCDLA absolutely understands that it's up to you to determine whether or not you think a harassment where it's physical contact but without injury is the same as an assault. And our thought is it's not, and our concern and our concerns are as I've outlined.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your testimony. There you go. Close the public hearing. We are adjourned. There you go. Close the public hearing. We are adjourned.